Well, it's still Kakalyaka, still in the morning time. And this is Naukana and Naleo Hawaiian Issues. And yeah, I had to go into music mode right now for Kaz, because she's in the hospital again. So Kaz over there, take care. And you're in the best place that you should be, in a hospital right now, so they can take care of you. Yeah. Health insurance, keep healthy and all that stuff. So our thoughts and prayers go out to you, cuz. Hey, once you put, they put you in a room, give us a call. Charge you to the hospital. Oh no, it's toll free. Yeah. But, I wanted to, start off with some, I don't know. I've been playing Don Ho recently, just reminiscing from kids' time. Because in the 60s, when I was growing up in California, that's all we listened to, and was Don Ho. Mostly Don Ho. You still had Kahoona Lake Trio and all the rest, but Don Ho was the man right there. So just playing some reminiscing. But I was also looking at just what's going on in the world and some of the people have passed. My Auntie Benedine in San Francisco that we went up to celebrate her life there. And just what are we doing here? And I know one thing for sure, in all the uncertainty of life, I know one thing that why I'm here is to stand up with my uncles, my aunties, my ohana, friends and families who are standing up for our aina, for our country. I know it's really hard and difficult for Americans to, you know, aren't we all happy natives down here? Aren't we happy to be part of the United States? Well, if you're Hawaiian, then you probably lost most of your land, if not everything, under this system. We know that. Hawaiian families go through it all the time. For those of you who don't know, just look at the paper. Look in the back legal section. Most of the time, you're going to see quiet title actions against Hawaiian families. And those quiet title actions against Hawaiian families, and they usually go back to the Great Mihele. And that's in a country that right now the Americans and others don't acknowledge. They say it doesn't exist. Yet they use the paperwork and laws from the Hawaiian kingdom. So all your property titles, if you look, goes all the way back to this nation that they say doesn't exist. But your title to your land would be in chaos because the only you can only trace it back to the kingdom of Hawaii. Which means the land you're on at one time belonged to a Hawaiian family. Belonged to Hawaiians. And as we see now, we're getting wiped out. Wiped out in Hawaii. Personally, my family, told you this before, but it's my experience, but we know, I've talked to many Hawaiian families, we know this is going on all over. Lost all our lands in Moloa. We got nothing in Moloa anymore. Because of this wonderful system that tax you out of your brains. And then Hawaiians either have to force to sell it, or you let the county take it for free. That's the reality Hawaiians live in. That's the reality that we see on a daily basis. Having to fight for our access going to the beach. Having to fight to keep our land. Having to fight because of the outrageous increase in land tax that they keep on putting upon the Hawaiian people. There has been some bright spots. We're about the Kuleana land tax that gives Hawaiian families a break on the taxes, which is great. Why? Because it keeps Hawaiian lands in Hawaiian hands. And that's where we are. We're in Hawaii, right? And yes, if you didn't know, Hawaiian is not someone who's born here. Okay? And I emphasize this because I see it every day. Not only have they taken our nation, they're taking our lands. As we speak, it's not 1893. We're talking right now, 2016, they're taking our lands right now. And then they have just a flat-out lie to us. The Department of Interior from the United States government under the administration of President Obama comes here, tell us what you want. And we tell them, they go, oh, we don't want that. We're gonna do this anyway. We're gonna put you under our program, and you're gonna be treated just like the, I don't want to say American Native Indians. They're their own people, the Cherokee, Puyallups up in Washington, Navajos, all of them. The United States wants to put us into that category. And we know how wonderful they've been taking care of the Indians. We know that, right? It's a joke. And just recently, I never heard of this tribe. And I hope I don't damage it, but I don't know how to pronounce it. Menominee. Probably that's wrong, but if someone knows how to pronounce it. But it's an Indian tribe in Wisconsin. Now, these have, they have the recognition that is being offered to the Hawaiian people. And all this, how else can I say it, crap propaganda that's being put out there for the Hawaiian people, which the majority of Hawaiian people, according to DOI testimonies, which I've seen, they're still trying to push this, that they're going to put us under the DOI program. And the Menominee tribe of Wisconsin, who has federal recognition, still has to sue the United States. Why? Because it is not self-determination. Okay? They let you self-determine yourselves as long as it's in what the United States wants. You look at the bottom line, including with the rules that they wanted us to adhere to and change so that we can be brought into this program, they are, when you look at it, the final word is United States. Okay, so you may get federal recognition, and that's why I was disappointed with Lily Kala and her discussion on the PBS program when she says, I want stuff now, which I do too, but not giving up our rights to control our lands just so that we can have something now. So her statement, Lilikala, and I worked with Lilikala Kalahui a long time ago, over 20 years ago. Her statement is false because we do not have the final say if we go under the DOI program, the Indian program. The United States has the final say. And that was brought up also in the seminars where the Apache people came down to, and we're here on Kauai. They're recognized, they have, they're in this federal program, but the United States took away their sacred lands. Why? Because they can. Under this self-determination Indian program that the DOI wants us to put us under, we do not, and neither do the tribes on the mainland, on the continental U.S., has the final say. The USA has the final say. So they were able to take Apache lands. Not in 1800. Now. Nowadays. Right now as we speak. So we're not talking 100 years. We're talking about what's happening right now. So they had to file in federal court. And we all know how that goes in court. Not only federal court, civil court, district courts here in Hawaii and across. It's absolutely ridiculous. The money needs to be spent. And you're given self-determination, but then you have to sue the United States because they're doing something wrong. And I'm not going to read the whole thing because it is kind of complicated. It's a lot of here and there, but the whole basic line is they gave them self-determination, which means nothing because the United States has a final say. They can come and do whatever they want. And basically, in a nutshell, they're claiming that the government owed them some money on some contracts, and the court held that they didn't file in time. And that's from the Supreme Court of the United States. See, so when I was raised, and I know many other people, you think of the courts as something very, you know, honorable. But when you look what has been done, especially for the Hawaiian people and other, and not even just Hawaiian people, you look at what's been done in other states to other people and even just regular Americans. You just shake your head. The system is cracking. And now we have Trump. You know, we met this lady who my wife was talking to her, and she was like, I want him. I want him because I don't want just a regular politician. But that's the alternative, Trump. Have you seen the riots that's happening outside his speeches? It's getting crazy out there. And I believe, and that's my opinion, but I believe with a lot of people, he just doesn't present himself presidentially. The way he says things off the cuff, even me, I'm like, if you're going to run for that position, then you have to have some kind of integrity and present yourself, in my view. And I know that many people agree, even the Republicans, are like, he doesn't present himself. But he's taking all the states, which means a lot of people agree with what he's saying, or at least he's winning. He's not losing. Now, you see the division in the Republican Party because it is split. I mean, the other three candidates now is basically down to two. If you look at the numbers, Trump has not won over 50%. The other two, and actually when Rubio was in there, they were splitting the votes. The votes that were not for Trump, when you combine them, are more than Trump. So that's what their deal doing is. And I'm only talking about that because I find it fascinating. Especially, I have not seen this kind of turmoil in the Republican Party for a long time. It's kind of shocking and surprising what's happening. They're really scrambling over there. But that's their culiano. But again, it's this whole system and the radicalness of that's what's happening in the followers of Trump. It's getting crazy out there. And especially for a system, and this is part of the system because the air ambulances, have you seen that? Even the local boy here, I think it was on the island of Kauai, he had to go to medevac him to Oahu. Got a bill for $35,000. Why? Because of the deregulation of the airlines. And these air ambulances are considered part of the airlines, so they, because they're deregulated and they're under that system, they get to charge anything they want. And they had the vice president of this air ambulance on. Shame. You save the person's life, and then you sue them after because they can't pay your $40,000 bill. Absolutely ridiculous. Absolutely ridiculous. But those are political policies that are in place. So that's one thing that I know it's got to change. And I feel for these families. They take the air ambulance and then their charges, and then they put through the ringer when they can't pay. Of course they can't pay. 40 grand for a 20-minute trip to Oahu or even on the mainland. It's just getting sick that the power of the dollar bill, people are really screw everybody. And they go, well, we can legally screw you. Same thing for the Hawaiians. They're telling us, forget about your country. They already know we're not. Okay? But we got these clowns in Niapuni who, they came up with a constitution really quick. And a lot of people are asking, well, how did you have that all set up already? I thought you were supposed to go into the convention and debate about what would be in the Constitution, supposedly, of us Hawaiians. But the question is, how come there was, basically, it was set up already? Because they already voted on the Constitution. So a lot of people go, well, how did they get that so fast? Now there's rumors around that a lot of the wordage was sent by Department of Interior. So they had already been planning this. They had the basics already set up before they even got there. But with all this stuff going around, I still believe in my people. I stand by those who are willing to speak for our people, to save Mauna Kea, to save our rights. And I mentioned this before, I really like the what's being done on Molokai, like Walter Reedy said, when the feds and the state guys come down there to tell the Hawaiians and their fish pond, hey, you got to do this, you can't do that. What did he say the Molokai people say to the state and fed guys? Beat it. You don't know what you're doing. You don't even live here. So don't tell us what to do over here. They'll back you up, Molokai people. Awesome. Tell the feds in the state, beat it. You have nothing to do over here. You don't even, you're part of the problem. So don't come over here and tell us what we have to do. We know what we need to do. You don't know what to do. So I want to thank Alan and Hope Kalai and Tim for passing off information, helping setting up Keanu Sai. And I was going to play the Keanu Sai, but I also Hope sent this thing about Umi Perkins, an interview with John Connie on Let's Talk Native on WBAI New York. And I tried to pull it up, but I couldn't. The URL didn't go through. So what I'm going to try to do is I'm going to try playing it on my phone. I couldn't pull it up on the computer here. And I haven't had, I haven't even reviewed this yet. So this is right off the cuff. And we're going to see if this plays. And we're going to check out the interview with John Connie on Let's Talk Native on WBAI in New York. Let's see if we can get this going. Let's see. Well, I'm trying to set that up. I'm going to play a song, and we'll get this going so that we can talk about the issues that are happening and the ideas that are coming out to help Hawaiians get our country back, get our lands back, get our rights so that we can secure our place in here in Hawaii. This is the only homeland that we have. Imua Hawaiians. Okay, so we're going to try this. It's an interview with John Connie on Let's Talk Native. It was on WBAI New York, and this was sent in to me by Hope Kaliso. Tim and Hope, mahalo plenty for getting this information out and helping us out to get this information to everybody. So, again, I haven't heard this, so we're going to see what it's all about. Okay, and that's like maxed out. Okay, so that ain't gonna work because I can barely hear it, but that's okay. Working off the cuff here right now. So what we're gonna do is, we have until like, I'm gonna play some music until 12 o'clock, and I'm gonna try to see if I can get it up on YouTube so we can have some more information from other people about what's happening with the Hawaiian causes right now in the islands. Because we got nowhere else to go, people. This is it. And when I listen to Hawaiians, especially Hawaiians that are know what's going on, like the DOI, I just like to go through it and listen to Molokai, to listen to Keokaha, to listen to Hilo, to listen to Nanakuli, to listen to Kekaha on Kauai, to listen to Kapa'a people. And you have everyone, the majority, vast majority, saying, hey, Hawaiians, you're doing what is right. You're doing what is right. Stand up for your land. Stand up for your people. Stand up for your country. Be patriotic to your country. So I'm going to play some music until 12 o'clock, and I'll see if I can get that up on YouTube. If I can't, then we're going to rely on, I think I'll go back to the DOI. Why? Because the DOI is going to have the Hawaiian people from a year ago telling you exactly how they feel. Try this one, and actually it looks like John it might be John Kane, maybe not Kane. I was pronouncing it Hawaiian, but he's a Mohawk activist, and I wasn't able to pull up this one that he was on WBAI, but it gives you an indication on what he's talking about, and I guess from a Mohawk perspective.
It's the Robert Saviola Show, sponsored by Buffalo Hypnosis. And now, from the beautiful studios of WBEN, here's Robert.
Again, we're playing an excerpt with John Kane, I guess you would say.
Welcome to the Robert Saviola Show. My name is Eric Polanski. Today I have a special guest, With me today is John Kane. John has a show, Let's Talk Native, on KB 1520 AM. That can be heard on Sunday evenings from 9 to 11 p.m. John's website is letstalknativepride.blogspot.com. His column appears in the Brainstream Media News monthly newspaper. It's an alternative paper here in Buffalo and Western New York. He's been a numerous guest in appearances on TV and radio. I just came back from doing a show in New York City. He's probably the most recognized voice speaking on behalf of natives. So welcome to the Robert Saviola Show.
John, how are you? Well, thanks for having me come on. Again, it's neat to come here and be a guest in a conversation rather than being a host. So, but I appreciate the opportunity to come on.
Well, my pleasure. Well, basically, instead today of asking questions, you'll be answering some. So basically, I'd like to, we have a few minutes left here. As far as you getting into radio and you becoming an advocate and even an activist, how did this all begin for you?
Well, I guess where it became more of a dominating part of what I do was back in 97 when we were in the throes of a tax battle during the Pataki administration. I was actually a part of the First Nations Dialogue team. And so myself with four other individuals, we went from territory to territory. We did some media events. I was writing quite a few letters to the editor. And I'd like to think that the efforts that we made in 97 played a big role in George Pataki flat out doing a 180 on the whole tax issue. When he came to Western New York and did a press conference at the Erie County Historical Society, he made a point to let us know that he was coming and that he had something to say that we were probably going to like. We were very skeptical. I mean, even as he walked by us and said, it's good to see you. You're going to like what I have to say. You know, there were plenty of us who were very cynical. And he took to the podium and said that as the executive of New York State, he was no longer going to pursue trying to collect taxes or impose New York State's regulations as it related to the taxing of tobacco and gas on the native peoples in New York State. And he basically stuck to that word through the remainder of his tenure as the governor of the state of New York. He vetoed every attempt, except for the final one, to try to do anything that was going to change the relationship as it related to our economies and our territories.
So since 1997.
That was the another interview. And what I decided to do on the one that Hope sent me, I can't get it to play really loud on the board here. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to use my microphone and I'm going to play it off my phone. Okay. And this is John Connor. He's a Mohawk activist. And, but before we do get into that, we're at the top of the hour. This is KKCR Hanalei, KQA Kilauea, and K28.4AL Haleiwa over there on the North Shore of Oahu. And Nalea Hawaiian Issues is made possible by listeners like you in partnership with Kamoa Ukulele and KCC Kauai Community College.
Kamoa Ukulele Company, dedicated to building high-quality bell-tone instruments. Built with a one-player-at-a-time philosophy, from student models up to custom masterpieces. Kamoa Ukulele Company, a family-owned business, supports KKCR. 652-9999 or online at kamoaukulelecompany.com.
The Hawaiian Studies Program at Kauai Community College, offering courses and experiences in Hawaiian language and culture for the children and friends of Hawaii. 245-8202.
And mahalo for supporting Kauai Community Radio. So, I'm going to play this off my phone, into the microphone. And this is John Connie, Kane. And he has a Let's Talk Native radio show on WBAI in New York. Take it away, Johnny. Here's Johnny.
San Diego, and welcome to Let's Talk with John Kane. I am John Kane. I am your host, and it is, as always, it's a pleasure to be here. And it's not just an honor or privilege to be here on WBAI in New York City each week, but it's also a bit of a
privilege and an opportunity for me to do not just the talk back segments that I normally do, but shows like today. Today is a special program. It is a program. It's subject matter that I've talked about before. You know, we're going to talk about Hawaii. We're going to talk about not only some Hawaiian history, but the current issues that the Hawaiian people are facing, and just exactly the role that the United States has played and is playing right now in some very controversial issues that are facing the Hawaiian people. I've got a couple of great guests. I have Umi Perkins, who has been a guest of mine on the show before, a great guest, and we're going to talk about some of what has transpired and some of what is currently going on. I also have joining me Ku Alana Fraser, who is going to talk to us a little bit about some of the same things, but she'll join us for hour two. For hour one, I have Umi Perkins joining me. Umi Perkins is a faculty member at the University of Hawaii. He produces the Umiverse blog, umiverse.wordpress.com. He's been a guest of mine on the show before, and it is a pleasure to have him joining me today again. First off, this program is only possible because we are on WBAI, listener-supported radio. We just recently came off of a fund drive, and we need to generate listenership, and we need to generate support for this program and for the station on an ongoing basis. So I want to encourage people to go to WBAI.org. You can go to the main body of that station's website, and you can click the donate button, or you can go to give the number two, WBAI.org, and make a donation there. You can also, on the give2WBAI.org page, you can go to the bottom of the page, and there is a tab called the Product Index, and it lists a lot of the books and CDs and that kind of thing that have been offered on the station. And as it happens, one of the books that is on the station's page is Restoring the Kingdom of Hawaii by Francis A. Boyle. It is a book that they have in stock. You can make a contribution to the station and look up that product. And again, it's called Restoring the Hawaiian Kingdom by Francis A. Boyle. You can look for that product, and it'll relate to some of what we're talking about today. Now, the other thing I want to do is I wanted to mention that on March 23rd at 7 o'clock at the Brooklyn Commons, I will be featuring and screening a film. I will be screening Older Than America. It's a film by Georgina Lightning. It involves the residential schools. It is a drama. It is a full-length motion picture about residential schools and the historical trauma that was imposed by those things. It is starring Georgina Lightning, Adam Beach, Bradley Cooper, Wes Studi, among others. It is a great film. I think it'll make some people think. It'll open up some eyes about just what transpired in this over 100-year period of Kill the Indian, Save the Man. That's a film that I will be screening on March 23rd. At the Brooklyn Commons, downstairs in the media center behind the cafe. I look forward to having having a full house. We screened a couple of films there before. I've screened the Doctrine of Discovery film, and just like with those two screenings that I did in the past, I hope we can spend a few minutes afterwards and maybe talk about the issue. I won't keep everybody too long. It is mostly intended to entertain and educate people about some of what transpired during that shameful part of U.S. history. So anyway, that's an event coming up, and I wanted to mention that. And of course, I need to encourage people, support the program, support the show, go to WBAI.org and give to WBAI.org, and that is the best way to do it. It is my pleasure and privilege to be here on WBAI FM 99.5 and streaming everywhere on the live stream at WBAI.org. And for those who hear this show and want to encourage others to hear it, you can always go to the archive page. So this show streams live on online. All of the archives of all these shows are online as well. And you can find all of that at WBAI.org. This is New York's Pacifica Community Radio Station, and this program is Let's Talk with John Cain. So now let me get right to it. My guest, as I mentioned, is Umi Perkins. Umi, it is a pleasure to have you join me once again. I know you've been gracious enough to join me on a number of occasions, but you know the Hawaiian issues and this issue related to how the United States is trying to essentially absolve itself of what really is just a terrible history, and they're trying to do it in much the same way that they've tried to absolve themselves of other wrongdoing. And so I want to get right into it. Let's start with a little bit of history. The Hawaiian Kingdom would be, the Hawaiian people would organize themselves under some very strong leadership from Kamehameha the First. The islands would be consolidated into essentially one people that would become known as the Hawaiian Kingdom. Why don't you take it right from there and kind of go through a brief history of Hawaii's unification, its international recognition, and then bring us right to when things started going badly with the United States.
Okay. Hey, mahalo, John. First of all, thanks for having me again. And I really, and many of us here, appreciate your ongoing interest in what's happening in Hawaii. And we really appreciate that. As far as Hawaiian history, this is what I do for a living, so I'll try to make it relatively brief.
We've got plenty of time, so go ahead.
Okay. So you hit the nail on the head by bringing up Kamehameha the First, because that unification or conquest of all the islands under one ruler is actually a prerequisite in international law for recognition as a sovereign, you know, independent country. So by contrast, the Maori in New Zealand, divided into 80 tribes, they weren't able to do that. They weren't able to become sovereign in the international system, whereas Hawaii was. So I always think of Kamehameha the First as creating a prerequisite for recognition of sovereignty, which was achieved under Kamehameha the Third in 1843. If you count the recognition by Britain and France as kind of the birth certificate, if you could say, of Hawaii as an independent state, and then followed immediately. U.S. recognition was verbal first in 1842 and then written in 1844. So it's all right at that time. You know, the three major naval powers of the world recognize Hawaii, and then other countries follow suit. Some new research by Keanu Tsai on this point I find very fascinating, which is that Hawaii had a treaty with Japan. We knew about this from 1871, but that was what was called an unequal treaty. So that meant that Japanese authorities didn't have actual jurisdiction over Hawaiian subjects or citizens of the Hawaiian Kingdom, that if citizens of the kingdom committed a crime in Japan, they would be tried at the Hawaiian consulate and not in Japanese courts. So it was similar to very, very early agreements that Hawaii had before their recognition with other countries. And it was actually Hawaii that recognized Japan as a fully sovereign country in 1893. It was actually literally within a day of the overthrow. Hawaii actually brings Japan fully into the family of nations. So that kind of shows you that it's really interesting, because Hawaii is sort of discovered, I'm putting that in quotes, pretty late, right, 1778, but it's fully integrated into the international system really early. So, 1843, it's the 33rd member of the family of nations.
You know, one of the things that happens, and I understand the importance of the relationship that the Kingdom of Hawaii would have with European powers and ultimately with the United States and other nations. But you know, one of the things that we as Native people and through some of the good work with folks like Stephen Newcomb and others is there's always this tendency that everything in terms of international law is always viewed through the prism of Europe. And so, I mean, I know that many people celebrate Hawaiian Independence Day as this moment when the European family of nations or the international community, as defined by the European family of nations, would fully recognize Hawaii. But I, to be clear, Hawaii was a free and independent people long before that. And I think one of the things that's different about Hawaii versus Turtle Island, essentially, is that Nobody planted a flag in Hawaii and said, "Okay, now we claim this thing. We claim this land for the British Crown." When you talk about the discovery, you know, by Captain Cook and whoever else would wash up on your shores, nobody tried to pull that doctrine of Christian discovery authority or that policy on the Hawaiian people in the way it was done by Columbus and Cabot, all of these other people. This was different, and as a result of that, I think that's part of the whole thing is there was a level of organization, and although the governance of the Hawaiian kingdom would change, and then often and in many ways as Ken Osai's research has indicated, they began to adopt a lot more of a monarchy model that was established by Great Britain, but in a little bit of a different way. And this is one of those things, you know, in when people talk about the word sovereignty or the sovereign, I mean, one of the what I consider to be one of the biggest lies ever told was that somehow God specifically ordained a specific family to rule over other people. And that's what a lot of the monarchies of Europe was based on. They made it sound like it was a spiritual intervention. It was like that God himself, that these monarchs were essentially, were almost godlike themselves. The difference in Hawaii is there was a process of unification, conquest, if you will, but unification of the islands Kamehameha established, not only the kingdom, but his rule over that, through leadership, not because of some sort of ordainment from the church to do so. So I wanted to say that a little bit because I think it's important, because even as, while I think all of this international recognition that comes in the mid-1800s is important, I don't want for a second to diminish the fact that the Hawaiian people, the Hawaiian kingdom, was a free and independent people prior to that as well.
No, it's a good point that I don't think we realize nowadays how incredibly remote Hawaii was. And so what that meant was a few things. One was that it took decades for sort of American policy to get to the point where they really thought of Hawaii as a desirable outpost, if you will. There was a military officer, Schofield, who came and kind of reconnoitered Hawaii and especially Pearl Harbor, which is basically where I live, as a strategic point. But there was a kind of a process over several decades of going to Washington and people kind of saying, what are you doing not taking over this place?
And now what year would that be when you're talking about?
That was in the 1840s.
Okay.
And he's still sort of making that pitch in 1880s. As a much older man. But then, Teddy Roosevelt comes in and sort of jumps onto that. Mm-hmm. And the Secretary of State, James Blaine, at the time of the overthrow, they're all pushing this kind of agenda, which from a realist perspective seems to be a no-brainer. But
so one of the problems with that is that at the same time that U.S. interest is being piqued by all this, there is international recognition and distinction treaties that are being made with the Hawaiian Kingdom. So to some extent, there's two things going on. There is a full acknowledgement of the Hawaiian Kingdom at the same time that the United States in particular, and I'm not saying that they're the only ones that are expressing this interest, but obviously geographically, the United States is expressing a strong interest in their own interest, and I think this has to do with business interests, it has to do with military interests, it has to do with a couple of things. But this is where what I find fascinating about this is how much the international community just turned their back when the United States was doing what they were doing. And maybe you could talk about that a little bit.
Well, that's the other effect of Hawaii's remoteness. I mean, we're still trying to figure out right now what were the other countries thinking was going on in the late 1890s. We know that Japan protested against the annexation, and Britain would have protested, but it seems like there was a change in the policy. They actually removed their ambassador, essentially, who had been for many years criticizing this sort of buildup of American influence in Hawaii. They replaced him with a much more conciliatory ambassador who kind of went along with it. But it seems like other countries, like we know Switzerland, for one, they actually thought that annexation had happened legally and didn't find out until a century later.
Well, I mean, part of the whole thing is understanding that, that communication, it's not like today where people know everything at the drop of a hat. I mean, it is entirely possible that things could happen on one part of the globe and people not know the true story or the reality of it for decades, and in this case, many decades later.
Yeah, I think that's true in general. It takes time for sort of information to move through the society, but with the remoteness of Hawaii, that was especially so. But I think more research has to be done about this question. A lot of people, the way that they sort of frame it is that the U.S. in 1894, so right after the overthrow but before annexation, had sort of put out a notice that, and the widow's phrase was, any attempt to influence the islands will be considered an act hostile to the United States.
Well, and let's back up a little bit. So, and not too much, because what happens essentially in 1893 is that a small group of businessmen, mostly sugar plantation folks, Dole is among these people, the famous pineapple guy, right? Dole Pineapples. But in that group, it's not just Americans. From my understanding, this group that would somehow try to make the statement that the Hawaiian Kingdom was no more, and now it was the Hawaiian Republic, or the Republic of Hawaii. This is a bit of an international group. Am I correct in that?
It's Hawaiian citizens of American descent.
Okay.
And then Americans and a few Germans.
Okay. I didn't know if there was other Europeans involved, but I did understand there was more than just and again, so when you say Hawaiian citizens of American descent, so essentially they are, and I don't want to reduce it down to just black and white or brown and white, but they're essentially white people who have now been on the islands long enough that they are a part, they're essentially Hawaiian subjects, right? I mean, was that fair to call them? And that they...
Yeah, I mean, Stanford Dole said in his memoirs, this is a funny thing to say, but he said, if I weren't a Hawaiian, I would be a Bostonian.
Exactly.
But, well, this is a weird thing to say, but the, what that tells you is that he does consider himself Hawaiian. And,
that's
and
an acknowledgement,
he's,
yeah.
He's a Supreme Court justice, so he knows what citizenship is and that he has it because he's born on the soil.
So anyway, so this group, essentially with the help of essentially the ambassador, the minister Stevens, who was there, who's supposed to be a diplomat of the United States,
right.
they basically use that the fact that there's a certain naval presence, marine presence that's there, and they just kind of do this coup, and it's essentially a nonviolent coup. They load up some guns and some cannons, and they basically said, we're taking over the palace. And then they do this, and they basically say that they are now the government of the Hawaiian kingdom. And I mean, that's really what they did, right?
Right. And the overthrow itself is almost like a non-event. I mean, the whole question was always, how is the United States going to respond to this?
Also, how are the Hawaiian people going to respond to this? Because I think even within Hawaii, there's a certain amount of, oh, they can't do that, you know. And of course, there are people that are just kind of living their lives and almost a certain level of detachment from the, you know, from again the monarchy, the political systems. Because this isn't just, it isn't like today, you know, when people think about every individual being a subunit of a government, essentially. And you know, the whole idea of citizenry is a different concept today than it was in 1893. So when you say it was a non-event, it's because there was probably a certain level of incredulousness that, you know, that frankly, even the Queen had, that said, well, we'll solve this. We'll resolve this conflict.
Right. By then, they understand the international system, and it's kind of like, you can't do this. And it was done unauthorized. I mean, okay. So there's some research coming out that found some secret telegram messages that were encoded that is starting to change that history, that maybe it wasn't that maybe was authorized. We're still trying to...
Covertly authorized, that. Anyway.
Yeah, covertly authorized. And that's actually a plan of that wasn't carried out the way that it said, but to actually shell the major towns in Hawaii and ending in Honolulu. Well, we still have to look into that. The person who did the research passed away right after it kind of came out. I have to go back and look at the code book. But it's an interesting time to be in the field of Hawaiian history because a lot of these things are being rewritten.
So this thing isn't really successful in 1893. In 1893, you know, of course, some of the political things that are happening back on the continent, you know, there's obviously administration changes. There's the Grover Cleveland, who, you know, who's from, you know, from Buffalo, New York, ironically, because yeah. that's essentially where McKinley would be assassinated. But Grover Cleveland, when he looked at the protests from Queen Liliuokalani, said, this is wrong. And so he essentially stops what is this fake attempt at an annexation treaty. And so there is no annexation treaty. So there is never a recognized treaty from the Hawaiian people. All that was ever produced was something by, again, this consortium of businessmen claiming to be the Hawaiian Republic. And it is essentially rejected during the Grover Cleveland administration. And so, but there still isn't and even though Cleveland is trying to work with the Queen, he is met with a lot of resistance by Congress. And so there still isn't the full restoration of the Queen and the Kingdom. It kind of stays in this limbo. And then, of course, the Spanish-American hostilities erupt. And then the whole thing is just washed over by an illegal or by a process that is outside of the U.S. Constitution, rather than an annexation treaty, which has to be approved by signed by the president and approved by 2/3 of the Senate. They go to a joint resolution of Congress, which has no legal authority, and that's been well established throughout history to do so. Through this joint resolution of Congress, they attempt to claim what they call the Hawaiian territories for the United States. And so that happens in 1898, is that correct?
Right, that's right.
So
that's a good summary.
And so it just kind of washes over. And again, yeah. The international community is pretty silent on this issue. All of those 45, 46, 47 treaties that existed with the Hawaiian Kingdom, none of those treaty partners are making the sufficient noise to say, wait a second, what is the United States doing here? And of course, we understand that the United States is now getting involved in hostilities with Spain, who is pretty formidable in terms of their navy and their presence throughout not only the South Pacific but South America, you know, Puerto Rico, Cuba, all of these places. So
yeah. So the interesting thing is that even with the Spanish-American War having broken out, there's still not sufficient support in Congress for an actual treaty of annexation. And so they just kind of fudge it. They just kind of say, well, we annexed Texas in this other way. The thing with a lot of these arguments is that people don't really understand the very, very basics of international law, which is that it's a law involving multiple countries. So what they do is they use American law to justify annexation when American law is not the arbiter of that, because it's it involves two countries, not just one. So there's a lot of basic things about the way the world is set up that Americans don't tend to know, because Americans are kind of notoriously insular. But yeah, that's a good summary. And this question of the lack of an annexation treaty is a critical point, especially coming into this constitutional convention. There wasn't even agreement among Hawaiians about.
Well, and again, in order for there to be a treaty, there has to be two consenting nations. And the fact of the matter is that this small group who's claiming to all of a sudden be the government of Hawaii was clearly met by the Queen's appeal, by some, 40,000-50,000 signatures, which represented the bulk of the Hawaiian population. It was clear that there was no consent. It was clear that this government did not exist, again, it was not the consent. They weren't governing by the consent of the governed, you know, which is supposed to be an American standard. So none of that stuff existed. So it was clear that the annexation treaty that was proposed was not from a lawful party representing the Hawaiian kingdom or the Hawaiian people. And so that's why it doesn't exist. And of course, that is why Grover Cleveland rejects the notion, and it never goes before the Senate. So there is no annexation treaty. But what they try to do in a joint resolution in 1898 is something, and I know people try to liken it to what took place with Texas, which is a completely different issue, because Texas, how, you know, Texas is contiguous. It, there's a different relationship on how Texas becomes essentially a part of the United States. It's a completely different scenario as opposed to an independent people that has this this attempted coup take place. You know, so when I hear people say, well, you know, a joint resolution of Congress brought Texas into the United States, well, that's not exactly true. There was a lot that went on before that that brought Texas into the United States. And so it's a completely different story. But this is kind of where the claim that Hawaii becomes a U.S. territory. It comes out of this, all of this convoluted mess, violation of constitutional structures within the United States, violation of international law, certainly violation of the sovereignty of the Kingdom of Hawaii, the territorial integrity of Hawaii, and of course the people of Hawaii. That's what happens, and most of this stuff is pretty undeniable. I mean, there are some people who would make some, might raise some issues, and there's still some hidden facts, like you said. There's some stuff coming up about, well, how much was being directed from Washington, D.C. at the time when Stevens and Dole and these guys would try to do this coup, and the authorization of the use of the Marines in that situation. Some of that stuff is still coming into light, but when you look at it, it is clear. And it's not only clear from the historical record, but even the United States will make that admission. But we'll talk about that. Let me take a brief break. My guest is Umi Perkins. This is John Cain. This is Let's Talk with John Cain. And we'll be right back after this.
Again, we're listening to John Cain on WBAI, and that's in New York. And he's discussing Hawaiian issues with Umi Perkins. They're going over some historical facts right now, but it was interesting to know that we're getting... It's getting around the world already. They can't stop what's happening in Hawaii. They can't stop the Hawaiian people at this point. They're going to try, but they just can't do it at this point. The cat's out of the bag. We'll get right back to that interview right now, but see what's happening with the Ocean Safety Report right now.
Aloha, I'm Pat Durkin with your KKCR Beach and Ocean Safety Tip for today. The safest places to swim are at beaches with lifeguards. On Kauai, we have 7 lifeguard stations. On the North Shore, they are located at Haena Beach Park and the Hanalei Pavilion. On the east side, lifeguards are at Kealia Beach Park and Lydgate Park. South to west side locations are Poipu Beach Park, Salt Pond Park, and Kekaha Beach Park. These stations are staffed 7 days a week from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. Always check in with lifeguards no matter where you plan to swim. Conditions can change rapidly. For more information about today's ocean conditions on Kauai, visit kauaiexplorer.com. With today's Beach and Ocean Safety Tip, I'm Pat Durkin for KKCR Radio. Have fun and be safe.
Right, and there's a high surf advisory for the north-facing shores and high surf advisory for west-facing shores. So all the way from Kekaha, all the way around Napali, Hanalei, Kilauea, all the way down to Lehui, where it's pumping. Hanalei or Haena is 15 to 25 feet, Hanalei 14 to 18. And with that big, if you don't know what you're doing, you don't go out, okay? Kealia 4 to 8, Lydgate 3 to 7, and then 1 to 4 till you get to Kekaha side, and that's where it's 3 to 7. And that's the surf report right now, so take care out there. And we're going to continue with WBAI.
WBAI FM 99.5 and streaming everywhere in the world on WBAI.org. And of course, this show is available on the archive tab if you go to that.
And I don't want to turn it down because on the link that was sent to me, there's no way for me to control on where it is. So I'm just going to let it play. And again, it's getting the word out. Umi Perkins on WBAI in New York with John Kane.
You know, one of the largest media markets in the world. It's so important to me because this is a compelling story. It is real history. You know, let's face it. You know, the way American history is told, it is so propagandized to make it sound like that the United States has done everything right, and that every controversy the United States has ever been involved in has a happy ending, which is kind of the significance of this story, because when you consider just what was done and what was done unlawfully, and of course, you know, although we've characterized this overthrow in many ways as a non-event, there was violence. There were people who were killed. There were hangings. There were a number of things. My guest to really talk about this is Umi Perkins. Umi Perkins is a faculty member at the University of Hawaii. He is a student and a teacher of political science, and again, he is the publisher of the Umiverse, which is the umiverse.wordpress.com, which has a great deal of information on about this subject matter. Umi, I want to thank you again for joining me, but I want to get right into it, because this history that we just talked about, you know, it actually gets revisited in 1993, essentially 100 years after this initial attempt at overthrow and ultimate overthrow. Talk to me about it. This is the Clinton administration. This is 1993. And what comes out of this is, one would think, is such an admission, such a confession, such an apology, if you will. I mean, it's called the apology resolution. But talk about just what it was, and then we can get into how it got watered down significantly. Talk about that a little bit.
A lot of people criticize this apology law or apology resolution as not doing anything. It's just an apology and nothing else. But as a Hawaiian history teacher, this apology is huge for me, because now I can stand in front of my class and I can say the overthrow was illegal, and it's not even a controversial issue. I mean, Hawaiians say the U.S. did this. The U.S. says it did it. That wasn't a forced confession. Therefore, it's settled. It's a settled matter. And it is becoming more and more understood as a settled matter. I can talk more about that later, but the bill itself, so it's in November 1993, recognizing on the occasion of the 100th anniversary the historical significance of the overthrow, and then committing to a process of reconciliation. Now, it doesn't say what that even means or what that process would look like, but the people who sort of were behind this would say that it was sort of stepping in the right direction, that this is like step one. Step two would be federal recognition. The interesting point here is that sometimes this apology resolution is used, you know, in arguments about Hawaii's continued independence, because they've admitted that the overthrow was illegal, which sort of means that it simply follows that annexation is illegal. You don't even have to know the details of annexation to figure that out. But when people try to do that, some of the opponents of this say it's just a resolution, so it has no legal force. And then the irony behind that is that annexation was done through a joint resolution. So by their own argument, annexation has no legal force.
It's the Supreme Court, because when this apology resolution was used in a legal matter, the Supreme Court weighed in on this, and it is the Supreme Court of the United States that basically said that it's just a resolution, and a joint resolution of Congress has no legal force. And so this isn't just what they say. It is what the highest court in the United States says. And again, the irony is, it was the joint resolution of Congress that, you know, and I don't even know if it's really fair to call it authorizing annexation, because it's actually authorizing the claim of another nation. You know, again, it's like the Congress pretends, under this pretension, I guess you would say, that they have the authority to claim another nation, and that's what takes place. And again, even if you, because I've looked at some of the information on this thing, the Joint Resolution of Congress in 1993 was overwhelmingly supported. I mean, it passed by a large margin in 1993. The resolution that would claim Hawaii was only a simple majority, and it wasn't even a landslide vote. So, which is even more interesting, that you would think that if a joint resolution was going to have more weight, it would be the one that was almost, you know, unanimously supported, as opposed to the one that was marginally got through Congress.
The annexation resolution had a huge number of abstentions, which is interesting because it makes you think. I mean, I would speculate that those are people who are sort of like, do you want to vote against the Patriot Act in right after September 11th, right?
Right, right. So there was political expediency even related to how much you opposed something that was happening. Sure.
So like, why are you on our side? Are you on the enemy side? It's a kind of rally around the flag effect. And that's the remarkable thing, is that even with that effect happening, the U.S. is at war, the senators in the Congress there's still not enough support for an actual treaty.
Sure, sure. Well, and again, so when this happens in 1993, essentially this resolution was trying to pave the way through, again, some sort of reconciliation tied to this acknowledgement that something unlawful was done. And so there are those that would say this paves the way for Hawaii to become federally recognized in the same manner. And I want to be clear, because when the United States talks about federal recognition, or what I have coined as a phrase, Fed Rec, and I spell it F-E-D-W-R-E-C-K, it is like again the native situation on the continent. The United States, what they call federal recognition when it comes to the Department of Interior and the Native people, it is defined as a tribe, band, or nation of Indians subordinate to the United States. So it is not recognition of sovereignty. In fact, the only time they'll use the word sovereignty is when they throw the word tribal in front of it. Even when they use nations, they'll throw the word tribal in front of it. So, and when you do that, when you throw a word, when you take a concept like nationhood or statehood or sovereignty, yeah, and then you throw another word. You've changed the meaning of that word when you put a precursor in front of it. And you know, it's kind of like on the Canadian side when Minister Murray Sinclair suggested that the residential schools, as Canada was apologizing for it, they do this whole Truth and Reconciliation Commission, and he comes out and he says that the residential school era was cultural genocide. And for me, I'm thinking, what was wrong with the word genocide by itself? When you throw cultural in front of it, you make it sound like they were just somehow, you know, taking away beads and feathers or something like that. You're ignoring the fact that people were killed, that there was sexual abuse, physical abuse, psychological abuse, all of this stuff happening. So when people put a word in front of it, in front of a well-established international term, then it changes the meaning. And so that, I think, is what is important here, as people understand what this notion of FedRec is, as opposed to independence. And then we'll get into some of the other details. But again, so this apology resolution lays the foundation for some means, although it's not clearly defined, and it certainly does not. It is in no way intended on the United States part to negate the fact that they have unlawfully claimed the Hawaiian Islands as their territory and ultimately made it into statehood. So that is
right.
Clearly established after the fact, and the Supreme Court weighs in on it to make sure that people understand that.
Yeah, I just want to say they did that, what you're saying, putting a word in front of sovereignty. They did that in the apology law, which was the word was inherent. So they said Hawaiians had never relinquished their inherent sovereignty. And so there is a little bit of debate that kind of people kind of didn't notice at the time, except for Keanu Sai, who was bringing up that this is that changes things. But then, as you said, at the end they say Section 3 is a disclaimer, a one-sentence disclaimer. Nothing in this joint resolution is intended to serve as a settlement of any claims against the United States. So, like you said, with the Supreme Court, they sort of reaffirm that this doesn't really mean much.
It is a clear admission, at least on the events leading up to the quote-unquote annexation. It is an acknowledgement that there's a fair amount of detailed history. And, of course, a lot of that detailed history came out of the Grover Cleveland administration when he had, what's the name of the gentleman that he had do a full investigation on this?
James Blunt from Georgia.
Yeah, right, James Blunt. And so the Blunt report kind of details, you know, just how much this thing was done in an unlawful manner. And it's interesting because I know there was a quote from a congressman in Texas who basically said what they were doing with this joint resolution was doing lawfully what they can't do lawfully, or something to that effect. And I know there was a quote somewhere along the line that they knew. I mean, there was a full acknowledgement by members of Congress that what they were doing through this joint resolution was to do something they could not do legally.
The interesting thing about this resolution is that it's, it's kind of like the Constitution that was just produced. I mean, there are some good pieces in here, but then it sort of skews the whole process toward better recognition, which is kind of self-contradictory.
They have this resolution. This resolution lays the foundation that ultimately would begin what was known as the Akaka Bill. And Akaka was a senator from Hawaii, a U.S. senator from Hawaii. And this whole idea, again, under the Akaka Bill, is essentially towards turning Native Hawaiians, the Kanaka Maoli, but Native Hawaiians, into essentially a federal Indian tribe, a recognized, tribe within the same context of Indian recognition, federal Indian recognition, and this,
right, which completely goes against all history. You have to not really know any history to think that that's a logical step. Williamson Chang had put it this way. He said it would be like the United States going to England and saying, we're going to create a federally recognized tribe of Anglo-Saxons in the United States, but they're going to, the Anglo-Saxons who live in England. That's kind of what they're doing with.
There's so many problems with this whole thing. But again, the United States already has a bit of a history having done this in the same illegal act over and over and over again throughout the continent. And they did it oftentimes with no legal principles involved. And this whole idea, I mean, we get into this debate as I'm a Mohawk, a part of the Haudenosaunee of the Six Nations. We get into this debate because on one hand, we have treaties with the United States that we didn't draft, that they drafted, that make it very clear that the United States recognized who we were, what our territories were, and the United States would never, and they said it in treaties like Canandaigua, for instance. They said the United States acknowledges that our land is ours and they will never claim the same. So we have that in 1794, and then 40 years later, you have a series of Supreme Court decisions that basically say Native people never held title to the land, and that they, that whatever sovereignty they had was necessarily diminished the moment they were discovered. And so you have these conflicting views, and that notion of the doctrine of discovery would actually lay at the foundation of land title throughout the entire continent. And I don't mean just the United States. And this thing, this is a legal principle that would dominate the world and give European Christian nations the power, it's the premise for the whole colonial period. So that happens. And so when you look at this, how absurd it is for in modern times for the United States to think that they could resolve this terrible crime they committed against a sovereign nation and a sovereign people and a sovereign territory by saying, okay, we're going to turn you into a subordinate tribe, and essentially, and there's no question about this, the recognition that the United States has towards Native people, it actually defies any standard for not only indigenous rights, but for human rights and civil rights. And so this is what was being pitched through the Akaka Bill for all intents and purposes.
Yeah, and the ironic thing is the view is kind of like, we'll turn you into a tribal nation if you're lucky. It's like you're happy to fight for it. And the thing that I can't understand is Hawaiians on this side who they believe in this approach so much that they're actually kind of vehemently against independence. I'm looking at this article. I highly recommend a series of articles on a site called the Hawaii Independent, which is hawaiiindependent.net. So it's called What Really Happened at the AHA. The AHA was a meeting to create the brand new, what they call Native Hawaiian Constitution. But one of the main proponents of federal recognition in Hawaii is a woman who came from Alaska and really pitched this model of Alaska Native Corporation.
Is this one of the Danners?
Yeah. So DJ Danner, this article, this is really, really rich. The
Dependent. It's totally dependent on a lot of U.S. support. The United States, how independent is the United States? And most of its debt is held by China. So when we talk about independence, it doesn't mean living in a vacuum, and it doesn't even mean self-sufficiency. It may mean autonomy and the right to govern yourself, but it isn't like, again, Hawaii is no longer this remote island that can live off on itself. Totally free and independent from any world influences. That's not, nobody can do that, no matter where you're located on the planet. The world has become a smaller place. So that's a different thing. So this Akaka bill, which is an attempt to take Native Hawaiians, put them under the Interior Department in the same model, of federal recognition of Indian tribes and bring it within the Interior Department, essentially. It languishes, and it basically fails as a bill. Eventually, Daniel Inouye, who was one of the other senators, both of these guys are no longer in Congress or in the Senate. Daniel Inouye passes away. Daniel Akaka is no longer in the Senate. And so it essentially dies. But now this idea of turning Hawaiians, Native Hawaiians, into an Indian tribe doesn't die with the Akaka bill, because now the Obama administration says, well, I have certain executive authorities to do certain things, and there may be a way for me to do this that doesn't require an act of Congress. And so he starts revisiting what are the rules within the Interior Department as it relates to federal recognition. Now, keep in mind, federal recognition, as defined by the Department of Interior as far as tribes, is an unbelievably ridiculous bureaucracy. There are, I've got some friends who live down on Long Island, and they are the Shinnecock. They spent 30 years and $33 million trying to pursue federal recognition. The number of people, when the United States says that there's 565 federally recognized tribes, let's be clear. That doesn't mean that 565 Native groups of Native peoples went through a federal recognition process. That is essentially what the United States reduced their recognition of sovereign Native territories too. It wasn't like all these people lined up and said, okay, let me go through the process. So the idea that through the Obama administration, he was going to do a rule change, and that's what this whole Interior Department thing was about, proposing a rule change that would streamline a process, bypass hundreds of Native peoples in the United States that have been mired in a federal recognition quagmire, bypass all those people, and then turn 500,000 Native Hawaiians into the largest Indian tribe within the authority of the United States. That's what was being proposed by the Obama administration, and that's only a couple of years ago. And when he does that, he does this in an attempt to gain support from Hawaiian people. He has a series of hearings. And there was like 15 hearings throughout the Hawaiian Islands. Explain again to my audience exactly what transpired out of those 15 hearings.
So that was oral testimony. It was about, I would say, 98% of the oral testimony was against the rule change. So most of those, you can kind of assume the majority of those were in favor of independence. There were a few that were against the rule change, but not in favor of independence. But the majority were in favor of independence. In fact, some of the few that were in favor of the rule change were actually commissioners on the commission that was set up to get this whole process going. So it was kind of amazing. It was overwhelmingly against the rule change. And I wrote an article in the Nation magazine covering that and asking the question, is Hawaii an occupied state? But then there was the written testimony, and the what's called the Hawaiian Civic Clubs, which are probably the most grassroots way that Hawaiians are organized, because they're by community, and it's incredibly mainstream. And so they had sort of like a form letter that you could send in. And so when the report finally came out for the rule change, it completely ignored the oral hearings, which was a really, really big deal, and only focused on the written, because the written came out about 65% in favor of federal recognition, essentially.
So what happens is they have 15 hearings throughout the islands, and of course they even had some on the continent. But again, 98% of the people who took time out of their busy day, traveled to these hearings, sat through the hearings, grabbed their few minutes at the microphone to give their personal testimony. 98% of them absolutely not only opposed the rule change, many of these people opposed the idea that it was the Interior Department that was approaching them on the subject rather than the State Department. There was a huge outcry from these people. And in fact, you know, as these hearings continued, there was even more and more security that was being brought in from the Bureau of Land Management and other places, because the volume and the passion that was being displayed there, that somehow the Interior Department representatives and representatives, again, from the state agency, OHA, the Office of Hawaiian Affairs, that they may not be necessarily safe. So for all of that that took place, what they did is they discounted and they dismissed almost all of that oral testimony, and then relied on faceless form letters that were just sent in most, you know, electronically for the most part, to the Interior Department, and said this was the overwhelming support we had for a rule change. A faceless, effortless, not even, you know, personalized response to this thing came in the form of these electronic, predominantly electronic communiques. And that's what the United States, and that's what the, and again, you can't get away from this. That's what the Obama administration's Interior Department did. They totally ignored. And these hearings were pretty well covered. I mean, there's a lot of video, there was news coverage. It was pretty well established that these hearings were not going the way the Interior Department wanted them to go. But again, they dismissed it all. But again, even with their assessment of this thing and their report on it, they kind of knew that as much as they characterized it as being supported through these electronic through these written testimonies, that there was still a problem.
All along the way, there are a lot of problems.
What it still seems to ignore is that there was a legitimate government that you could argue still has a legal right to exist, which is the constitutional monarch. This still undermines the constitutional monarchy and creates a whole other process. And when they use words like, and this is important, when they use words like self-determination, the United States doesn't use that word in the international context. So anything that the state or the federal government are involved, where they use words like self-determination, they make it very, very clear that they don't mean self-determination in the international sense. They mean, and they flat out said it in some of their own documents, that they mean internal self-determination, a self-determination to organize themselves within the state structure, meaning the United States structure. So they don't recognize independence with the United States definition of self-determination. They don't recognize sovereignty over natural resources, which means land as well as, you know, any other resources on the land. And that's well established, because the United States took this position at the tail end of the Clinton administration, ironically, because of the conversations that were coming out of the international community with the Organization of American States, with the UN Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous People, and even some of the conventions associated with trying to end racial discrimination. The United States wanted to make it very, very clear that their view on what self-determination was, on what defined a people's or a collective right, this is all documented in their own national security documents and proposals. And they put it out there, and they said, we are always going to have a problem with these international documents if they don't clearly define or take in our definition of self-determination. And that's essentially why in 2007, the United States voted against the UN Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, because the language didn't change. And the only concession that exists since 2007 is that the United States is saying, well, we didn't get the language change that we want, but when we say self-determination, people need to know that this is what we mean. And so this whole process still undermines the notion of the Hawaiian kingdom. And it essentially, even without the language of FedRec in there, it still is an effort to reshape the Hawaiian people into something that is a subordinate people, even with the concession, even getting independence language in the document, it is still primarily geared towards being subordinate to the United States.
And that comes to the end of our program for Nali Hawaiian Issues. I did enjoy playing that for you guys. I know it was going over some points that we already know, but it's important that this was done on WBAI in New York. And yeah, it's a public radio station. Yeah, we know that the mass media is against us. But the cat's out of the bag. I talked to some very conservative Hawaiian elders, and even they said, and I agree with them, I haven't seen this in the years I've been with the Hawaiian sovereignty movement. We're in a state where they just can't stop it anymore. The cat's out of the bag. The Hawaiian people know what's going on, and we are going to pursue our rights and our country. That's the bottom line. So I really want to put out a shout out again to Hope and Tim Kalai for bringing that to my attention. And that was an interview with John Kane, who is a Mohawk activist, and he has a talk show called Let's Talk Native on WBAI New York. And hopefully, we might even contact him and see what he has, because he really shows that his knowledge and he read the documents on the Hawaiian sovereignty movement and the overthrow. Very akamai and very proud that a non-Hawaiian has looked at the paperwork too, and like many other non-Hawaiians have said, hey, this is wrong and it has to be corrected. So mahalo to Hope and mahalo for John Kane for bringing that to the attention to the people who are listening in New York, and for Umi Perkins, professor from University of Hawaii. Oh, and a side note too. Go Bulls. Right on for the basketball. Side issue, but hey, still awesome that they got their first win, so we'll see how that goes. So mahalo for Nale Hawaiian Issues.